Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, June is Invasive Species Action Month, and that makes it a good time to learn how to identify, report, and control invasive species we find throughout the state. Today on the show, we'll talk with a variety of experts about the many plants and animals that are regulated in Wisconsin. One of our first guests is Mark Renz. He'll talk about terrestrial invasive plants. He's a weed scientist, a professor, and extension specialist at UW-Madison. Mark, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm happy to have you along, and I'm also happy to have Kelly Kearns with us as well. She's the invasive plants coordinator for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program of the Wisconsin DNR. Kelly Kearns, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
At 11:30, we'll move into aquatic invasives, and then at noon, we'll focus on forest pests. But first, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about Wisconsin invasives? Join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Kelly, let's start with you. Tell us about your background and work with the Natural Heritage Conservation Program.
Sure. The Natural Heritage Conservation Program is part of the Department of Natural Resources, and we work with all the rare species of plants and animals, all the state natural areas, and then there's those of us that work with the problem species, too, such as the invasives. And so we have a small crew dealing with invasives, and I'm one of the people dealing with terrestrial plants.
Mark, you're kind of a weed guy. What's happening in your lab? New research going on?
Well, we're just continuing with some of the same. We work in a large area involving agronomic weeds as well as natural area weeds. And I think there's no lack of work. Let's just put it that way. But we're really excited to do the work with the natural areas. We've been doing a lot of predictive modeling and trying to continue to provide new information on how to manage these effectively and efficiently to restore these areas where they belong. So happy to share a lot of this information with the audience.
Yeah, and June's a good month, I think, to spread awareness about invasives. Any special goals for this year, Kelly?
Well, it's been kind of a tough year to be doing much outreach with people. So one of the things that we are doing now is putting up a lot of boot brushes around the state at some of the parking lots and trailheads of state properties. And these are boot brushes with the Play Clean Go logo. And this is a kind of a branding that has been developed that Play Clean Go Week is next week. And it's a campaign to get people to clean their gear, clean their boots, clean their dogs, so they're not taking seeds and other invasive plant parts from one place to another. And so we're hoping to get these boot brushes out there to get more people to be aware of how they can help to keep from spreading invasives.
Very interesting. You know, Bob in Madison has a question right for you, Kelly. So let's go there. Bob, hi.
Yeah, I see a lot of, I look at a lot of gardening pictures on Facebook, and every now and then I'll see a picture of an invasive species like forget-me-nots or Dame's rocket. And the poster will say, oh, isn't this a lovely feature in my garden? And I guess I would like some advice on how you can respond to the person who posts the images of these invasive plants, telling them that that they are invasive and they should be eliminated from the garden. Because oftentimes people will say, but it looks so lovely in my garden, and I've never had any problems with it getting out of hand. And how do we educate as a citizen these issues on social media without coming off too snarky?
Sure. Okay, well, to some extent, it depends on where they are located. And in some cases, you know, some of those plants, if they're in, you know, Quebec or someplace, maybe it's not a problem. If they're in Wisconsin and it's a species, it's actually a regulated species, you might be able to let them know that it's a regulated invasive species here. You might also want to let them know that the spread isn't always on their own property. So a good example of that is purple loosestrife. For years, people planted purple loosestrife in their gardens, and then the seeds would get spread by rainwater down into a drainage basin of some sort, and then they would spread into an adjacent waterway. And so an individual landowner didn't know that that population of purple loosestrife that was a quarter mile down the road was because of their plants, but it probably was. And so that's a good way to kind of describe that some of these seeds might get picked up and moved in ways that they're not noticing it.
Thank you very much, Bob, for calling. Teresa in Racine has something for you, Mark, I think. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, thank you for the call. I'm wondering about fleabane. So I know that fleabane can be very beneficial, but in my garden, it just reseeds itself every year and it takes over, and I'm constantly pulling up tons and tons of these huge plants that get to be 3 feet tall. And so I'm wondering if there's some way that we can control that a little bit without completely wiping it out.
Yeah, so there's several fleabanes, I don't know, Kelly, like 4 to 6 that are really common and actually pretty difficult to differentiate. Many of them are native, so we wouldn't call these invasive, just weedy. And in these cases, they tend to be annuals where probably in your garden doing lots of mulching, trying to cover the soil surface so that there's not sunlight will probably prevent their emergence. I know I had a neighbor pay my daughter to pull all of her fleabane from her yard, and she made a lot of money doing it. So the key would be just to prevent seed production and try and limit the bare ground on the soil, and that'll probably be your best bet. There's a range of ways to control it. We just want to prevent seed production. It would be the best advice I'd give.
All right. Teresa, thanks. And well, as long as we are on the phones here, let's go to Steve in Hayward. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
I'm dealing with buckthorn. I bought an old farmstead many years ago, and there's buckthorn blended into the windbreaks all around and the property lines and so forth. And I've been working on it for a couple of years. I am not sure, though, and I've been cutting it and then poisoning the stump just as with a concentration of Roundup. And that I've had really good kill rate on that, but I'm not sure if I can continue to do that at this time of year. I've mainly done that in the fall and late summer, or even up until the end of till the snow comes.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, so first off, you're not alone in battling buckthorn. It's really common throughout the state, and we've kind of done that to ourselves by planting it. I think your approach is a really good one and really effective. It's called a cut surface or cut stump approach, where you cut the plant at the base and apply a concentrated form of the herbicide. There are several herbicides you could utilize to that cut surface. It gets absorbed and goes into the root crown and kills it. That can be actually done any time of the year, except when you cut it and you get some bleeding, and that comes out of the root stump. So you can do that any time of the year and be effective. There's a range of other techniques that can be utilized and other herbicides. But with these shrubs, we really like to focus on herbicides are really advantageous to give us a high effectiveness. If you're overwhelmed, one thing we do recommend is treating the female plants that produce the berries, because that can reduce the spread of berries onto other parts of your property and yours over the male ones, which are just going to be a nuisance. But sounds like you have the right approach, and you can do that anytime as long as it's not, the sap isn't coming up off that cut surface.
Just a follow-up to that, somebody wondering, is it illegal to grow buckthorn? If not, how do we get laws in place to make it illegal? What's the process on that, Kelly?
Sure. We have a law in Wisconsin, a rule called NR40, and it lists species as restricted or prohibited plants or invasive species. There's animals on that list as well. And for both groups of species, it is illegal to buy them, sell them, plant them, move them around, and in general, introduce them into the landscape. So, yes, it is illegal to do that already with both buckthorns, common buckthorn and glossy buckthorn. And it is also illegal to possess them if they are prohibited species. But those prohibited species are ones that either are not yet known to be here or are in only in a few places where actual eradication is feasible. And buckthorn is well beyond that. So buckthorn falls into the restricted category.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve. Appreciate your call. Mike in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Larry.
What can we do for you?
It's sort of a two-part question. We're plagued with creeping bellflower, and I'm wondering if your experts have a best practice outside of a flamethrower to control them. And the second part is, are there any invasive species that are so noxious that, in fact, if they're on your property, you don't take care of them, that the city can take care of them for you and charge you for their time?
Okay. Well, a couple of go to Kelly, I guess. Kelly, do you have a comment?
Sure. I'll take the second question, then let Mark take on the creeping bellflower. So there is a statewide noxious weed law, and this was put into place in the 70s. It only lists three species statewide as noxious weeds, but it allows municipalities, so townships, counties, villages, cities, to create their own noxious weed list. And so some municipalities have done that and others haven't. If they do have such a list, then it is up to that municipality to follow it. And so, for example, if they had buckthorn on that list, they could require that you try to control your buckthorn. They would have to be fairly forgiving because, as we know, it takes a long time to control buckthorn. But certainly a lot of municipalities do have such a list and actually do have somebody on staff that does that enforcement.
And Mark, the first part?
Yeah, so Mike, do you have any hand grenades handy? Because that's what it's going to take to get rid of bellflower. It's really, truly a problematic creeping perennial. We do have a fact sheet that lists some suggestions. If you can go to our website, wrensweedscience@cals.wisc.edu, or just Google Wrens Weed Science, and it'll come up. I've had success in locally eradicating it, but really the key is it's got these tubers and perennial roots that are deep down in the soil, and you really need to excavate those. The easiest way is to excavate all of the soil so you can sift through and take those out, which is really labor intensive. And when you think you pull it and you get it, you actually are breaking it off, and there's a big perennial root below there that it resprouts. So it's truly a challenge to manage in those areas. And if it's a small area, you can excavate and remove the soil. That's your best bet. Otherwise, it's a continual management situation. It's been planted everywhere in the Madison area and many other areas, and is really tough to get rid of.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Prairie in Clyde, Wisconsin, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I've got kind of a two-part comment / question about organic or chemical-free methods for controlling invasives. And I was just wanted to ask, as you're kind of talking about different invasive species today, if you could include, as you did with this last question, include chemical-free options. You know, a lot of us out there are willing to put in the extra labor that it takes. And I understand that, you know, the kind of the upfront cost is, especially when you're considering labor, sometimes more expensive. But, you know, I believe that the larger cost to our society of kind of this continual use of chemicals is greater. And with invasives, that's what it is, because they're, you know, once we start spraying our garlic mustard, it's not disappearing. It's going to diminish. But it's in our environment. And so if that's our our method for treating. We're just going to keep doing that on and on. So I wanted to encourage that, ask if you have any specific tips or resources for going to find find methods for controlling that way, and then also, you know, encourage, just put it out there to people that, that all of these things are possible to control without chemicals, but you just got to figure out the most effective way.
All right. Thanks for calling. Comments? Let's see. Let's turn to Mark.
Yeah, I know. I think thanks for the comments. I think, you know, when we write any of our recommendations, we try to include all management techniques that are common or likely and document the pluses and minuses of each of those too. So I think his comments are right and spot on. You know, we do not have to use herbicides to control these plants, but often that makes the job a lot more arduous to conduct. And some individuals may decide that using herbicides might be a more efficient use of resources. So we really are leaving it up to the user to make those decisions and point out some of those restrictions associated with it. So yeah, I definitely understand his comments, and I think he's bringing up some good points. And we need to think about holistically about what's the best technique that fits your situation and how to employ that. And there's lots of options that we have. We just need to think about what resources we have to conduct that management.
You know, I was thinking about a recent article and study that was published relating to garlic mustard that might have some application in what we've just been talking about. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, the research? I thought a less is more approach to controlling garlic mustard.
Yeah, Larry, I appreciate you bringing this up. This has been getting out into the media, and I think that there's some misinformation that's coming out, so we really appreciate the opportunity to bring this up. There's a really innovative long-term study that a group did across 16 sites across five states in the eastern and midwestern U.S. looking at what happens to garlic mustard populations over time, and what they found is in some of these sites, these populations were declining and had the potential to start declining over 10 to 20 years. And somehow that message has been translated into it's better when you have garlic mustard to do nothing and let it go away versus do something to manage. And I think, you know, I would dispute this argument. I think in some cases it does go away, but there's some potential damage that can occur if we do nothing. And so I would, as a scientist in the upper Midwest, I would say that we should evaluate those areas and in many cases do something versus nothing, because if it lays there and does invade, it may eventually go away, but there could be a cascade of impacts that happen across that timeline. And we don't even know when it'll go away. I mean, I just went out to some of the research plots that I was at 15 years ago, and those garlic mustard populations are still as strong as they were when I first came to Wisconsin. So 15 years is a long time to have a lot of impacts from this invasive plant. I would contend that we probably should evaluate those, and if we can keep it out of particularly high quality areas, we really should try to do so.
But in terms of pulling it, or what, Kelly, maybe you could comment further too.
Yeah, so in areas where it's just getting started or it's a small population, hand pulling is definitely worth doing because you can keep it from spreading in those areas by repeatedly hand pulling until you completely eliminate it. But you do have to really assess each individual site. If you have a 10-acre parcel and it's completely covered by garlic mustard, if you're planning on controlling that, you're going to be doing it for the next 10, 15 years, and you need to make sure you're going to have the resources to do it repeatedly for many, many years if you want to actually get it under control. So it really depends on your situation, on how large the population is and what your resources are, and if you have the capability of controlling it and what the quality of the site is. As Mark mentioned, really high quality sites, we want to make sure that they don't get taken over by something like garlic mustard. Whereas if it's a site that's a much lower quality site, maybe it's not as important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that some of the authors kind of mistakenly draw some conclusions that garlic mustard has no impact. And that's been clearly shown in the literature that trilliums and the survival of trilliums is dramatically impacted by garlic mustard, as well as another study showed native plant diversity and abundance is impacted by garlic mustard. So there are impacts of having it there. It may not be as bad as, say, Japanese knotweed or wild parsnip or something else, but there are impacts. If we can stop those, particularly in some of our really treasured areas, I know Kelly feels the same way as I do. We really should try to do that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned wild parsnip, and if I'm not mistaken, that's going to be starting to bloom soon in the southern part of the state. Maybe describe that, Kelly.
Sure. Wild parsnip usually blooms somewhere around the end of June, early July, and in the southern part of the state, a little bit later further north. And it is a tall umbel plant. And so umbel has an umbrella-shaped flower head. And this is the only one that gets really that gets fairly tall in the 4 to 6 foot range that has the yellow flower. And it's got large compound leaves, and it's typically found along roadsides and in other grassland areas that have not been mowed or only mowed periodically. And this is a plant that you really want to avoid getting near. At any time when it's green, you can get the sap from the plant on your skin, and that can cause a burn when it's exposed to sunlight. And so it's definitely a plant to be very cautious around.
Very good advice. Ryan in Broadhead wondered about pokeweed. Any advice for getting rid of pokeweed?
So pokeweed is an interesting one. We have a native pokeweed, and we also have a non-native one that seems to only be spreading in the Madison area, nowhere else on the continent, as far as reports are anyway. And it certainly is spread by birds. So if you want to stop it from spreading, then you got to, you know, take off the seed heads, and which is fairly easy. These plants also have a taproot. And so simply taking a shovel and taking it to that taproot and cutting that taproot, it would probably be the simplest way to go after if it's a smaller population.
And Jay from Orfordville, from Oxford, wondered if you could just keep mowing wild parsnip. Just keep mowing it down. Mark.
So there's been some really great anecdotal observations by land managers. If you can mow it, and the timing to mow it is really critical. So you want to mow it not when the flower on the top, but the side flowers, we call those the axillary flowers, start to turn yellow. That's usually right around the 4th of July. It's been getting a little earlier with climate change in southern Wisconsin. If you can mow it then, that plant won't die. It will resprout. It may even flower, but it doesn't have enough energy to produce viable seeds. And so if you can do that for 2 to 3 years at that same time, one mowing per year for 2 to 3 consecutive years, you deplete the seed bank and it eventually goes away. So it's a great example of a non-chemical approach to control. Now, the big reason why it fails often is people will mow those areas at the right time and it'll work really well, but then there's seeds still coming in from adjacent landowners and other people. So you got to control the whole population so no seed comes into the environment. That's the struggle.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. I know, Kelly, you're going to hang around for a bit. Mark Renz, our guest today, weed science professor and extension specialist at UW-Madison, our guest. And we're going to turn our attention next to aquatic invasives. Jade Rotunda, our producer today, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're learning all about the many invasive plants and animals that are regulated in Wisconsin on the show today. And now we're going to focus a bit on aquatic invasives. Maureen Ferry joins us. She's the Aquatic Invasive Species Monitoring Lead from the Bureau of Water Quality, Division of Environmental Management. Maureen, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here, Larry. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, great to have you here. Michelle Nault, our other guest, Lakes and reservoir ecologist at the Bureau of Water Quality. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. I'm happy to be here today.
And Kelly Kearns is sticking with us, too. She's the invasive plants coordinator for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program with the Wisconsin DNR. Just I'll let you know, just after noon, our forest pathologist, Alex Veltmeyer, and Mike Hillstrom, forest entomologist, will join us to talk about forest pests. But first, what do you want to know about aquatic invasives in Wisconsin? How are they helping to protect our state's rivers, lakes, and streams from invaders? Want to hear from you? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Maureen, let's start with you. Tell us about your work and the efforts you lead to protect and preserve our Wisconsin waterways.
Sure, we'll do. So I'm the monitoring lead for the state. I work with our lake, stream, and wetland biologists on how to look for invasive species and report them, and then give a little guidance on next steps once we do find things. We also work closely with citizen programs like the Citizen Lake Monitoring Network, Water Action Volunteers. They're all across the state. Volunteers are really like the eyes and the ears out on the landscape that are reporting these things. Half of our new discoveries come from citizens that are just out there trained and know what to look for, or just see something suspicious in their lake or the rivers that they use.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sure. Well, we collect all the data from all these different people, the DNR staff and then the different citizens. And we verify all the records and we share it out on our website so that people know what's present where and how to prevent it, where to be extra careful when they're going from water body to water body.
Michelle, let's talk to you for a minute, too. How about you? What's your area of focus here?
Yeah, so I'm the statewide lakes and reservoir ecologist for the Wisconsin DNR, and most of my responsibility involves providing some technical assistance and expertise on really a variety of lake and reservoir topics. We do a lot with aquatic invasive species. We do a lot with aquatic plant management, and we also have a very robust surface water grant program that's available for lake organizations and other eligible partners to actually apply for state funding to help with aquatic invasive species control, prevention, early detection. So I get my hands literally wet in a lot of different things.
Well, how do you two work together and maybe the other organizations that you partner with? Do you work together, Maureen?
We do work together. We have a pretty close-knit group in central office in downtown Madison. We work together on ranking these grants that come in, making sure everybody's using the same protocols, going through, like I said, verifying all the records are accurate.
And let's talk, you know, I'm a fisherman. I like to look for good weeds and aquatic plants out there when I'm out on the water. What are the benefits of aquatic plants? Maybe we can talk about that. Michelle, do you want to bring that?
Yeah, sure. So aquatic plants, and I'll refrain from using the word weeds because they're not weeds. Weeds are things that are not supposed to be there, correct? So aquatic plants are very important parts of lake ecosystems. They help keep the water nice and clear. They help provide habitat for fish and a lot of other aquatic organisms. And our good plants, our native plants, also can help prevent some of these non-native invasive species from being able to establish in some of these water bodies. And so really a healthy aquatic plant community is very key to a healthy lake. And we do sometimes deal with user conflicts with aquatic plants, but a lot of that really comes down to education and educating people about the many benefits that our good plants do provide.
What about some of those invaders? What are the new invaders that we ought to be looking out for? Maureen, do you want to start there?
Yeah, sure. So most folks are going to be familiar with things like Eurasian water milfoil, curly pondweed, purple loosestrife. There's a lot of other invasive species that can get into our lakes, streams, and wetlands. Some new discoveries that we've had to the state are things like Asian clam. It's like a mussel that's in the water where you've got the two shells that come together. You see a lot of the native species, which are good. They're good at like clarifying the water, but Asian clam are non-native ones. They look a little different. They're going to have a really ridged shell. They're only no more than 2 inches in length. And they feel like corduroy when you rub your fingernail across the shell. I wish I had a shell here and I could rub my fingernail over it so you could all hear it. But they're really distinct. That's a new species. They're mainly in southern Wisconsin and southeast Wisconsin and the Mississippi River. And then we've got a lot of plants that people are introducing on purpose. They're really beautiful, unusual plants. Things like butterfly dock or butterbur. It has a lot of different common names. We're seeing that in just a handful of places in the state. It's got huge leaves that might span up to two feet, 3 feet in width, and it can grow quite tall, 3 feet to 5 feet tall. We found that in a couple of places where it's escaped from somebody's yard and then can go along river corridors where it can become really problematic. So we want to make sure to remove that. We have removed populations in northeast Wisconsin, and then we're in the process of removing a population that's proximal to Lake Superior up north.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, also beautiful water garden plants like water lettuce, water hyacinth. We started seeing in different parts of the state too. Those are ones to keep an eye out for. They're so unusual looking that when we do find them, we know we get reported almost instantly.
Yeah. Kelly had mentioned earlier about purple loosestrife kind of starting on the land and then the seeds going down into the water. And then there you got purple loosestrife.
Yep. That's true.
that's how that works. Well, I'll tell you what, Scott in Iron River has a question for you. Let's go there. Scott, hi.
Hey, yeah, hi there, folks. You mentioned in a list of plants just a minute ago, a pondweed, and that's what I was going to call about today. I think there's a more technical term for that. I live on a small lake in northwest Wisconsin and used to have this flourishing population of the flowering lily pads, and now in the last 5, 6, 7 years or so, just totally being taken over and choked out by the little lily pads. And I was wondering if there are they an growth, and then what we, if anything, we can do about it. And before you answer, I just one of the things, it seems the only thing that they're very sensitive to mortars, and so I just try to encourage people to run the edges and try to keep it at bay, so to speak. And but is there anything else we can be doing about pondweed? And thank you very much.
Okay, Michelle, let's turn to you. Hi, got an answer for that?
Yeah, so there are a variety of different pondweeds in Wisconsin, and most of them actually are native plants. There is one non-native pondweed, and that's the curly leaf pondweed that Maureen mentioned earlier. It's potentially that might be what's in your system. It is a fairly common invasive, especially in the northwestern part of the state. Curly leaf is unusual in the fact that it grows very early in the growing season. Oftentimes, it'll start growing even under the ice. And it's also unusual in the fact that it dies back in the middle of the summer. So when many of our native plants are starting to really grow and flourish, this invasive just naturally starts to senesce. As far as management options, aquatic plants are managed in many similar ways that terrestrial plants are. There are some chemical herbicides that are allowed to be used with a department-approved permit. There also are mechanical ways to harvest nuisance-causing aquatic invasives, and also manual ways, just using your good old hands to remove some of these plants in areas where they are either causing recreational issues or maybe competing with some of our beneficial natives. If you aren't quite sure what plant you have, you can certainly take a picture and send that to your local DNR office or to myself or Maureen, and we would be more than happy to help positively identify that species for you and work with you on management options.
There you go, Scott. Thank you so much for calling. Dan in northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
My question is, you know, now that they've had the lamprey barrier for many years on the Blue River, and they do a great job of telling you how many fish go through in the spring and the fall and what have you. But my question is, they've never seemed to tell us how many lamprey are they actually stopping at that barrier? Or how do they have any control on that? Do they know how it's working? Is there any influence on that on the DNR?
All right, that's a good question. Maureen, what about it?
Yeah, I can speak to it a little bit. Fisheries is who manages the lamprey barrier, but I know that it's been hugely successful because they put those barriers where they know that the lamprey go to spawn. So that to stop the lamprey from coming in, they also release chemicals to prevent them from being able to spawn, or once they do, to get rid of those fish. And I don't have a good number for you on how many, but I know that there are people that are hired to count the fish that come through, the lampreys that do come through. I'll have to look into that, but I know that it's our DNR fisheries that oversee that. And we could, I believe, send out notes after the show for where to look for that information. But that's a great question.
Yeah. We can post up on the Larry Mueller Show page in our program notes for today's date if you can supply that information for us. That's great. Dan, thank you. Charlie in Southwest Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I'm not even sure if it's an invasive species, but my question is about watercress. Down here in Southwest Wisconsin, we got a lot of great trout streams, and they're fed by the springs, obviously. But I'm noticing over the years, the springs are getting really clogged up thick with watercress. And I don't know if it's, like I said, it's my understanding it's not even a native plant. But I was thinking, well, maybe I would thin it out because it makes a great salad. I'd hate to lose it all, but what do you think about that?
Michelle?
Yeah, thanks for your question. And you are correct that watercress is not a native species to Wisconsin, but it's a species that has been here since basically the early European settlers. And so oftentimes we refer to this as a species that's naturalized. It originally was not here, but it's become so kind of well-established in our state that, for lack of a better words, it's more part of our flora now. As you mentioned, it is a very tasty plant. I've eaten it myself in some salads. You certainly want to harvest it from a clean system. A trout stream is a perfect example of a, you know, nice, clean, flowing water system. And yes, I think that thinning it out through manual removal can help increase water flow and, you know, perhaps add a little bit of additional diversity there as well.
All right. Charlie, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Maureen Ferry, Michelle Nault, and Kelly Kearns, our guests right now as we talk aquatic invasives. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking about aquatic invasives on the show right now, a little bit later on, after noon, we'll be talking about those invasives that infect our forests, animals and wildlife, you know, all kinds of things that we can talk about then. But right now, Maureen Ferry, Aquatic Invasive Species Monitoring Lead from the Bureau of Water Quality, Division of Environmental Management, one of our guests, Michelle Nault, Lakes and Reservoir Ecologist at the Bureau of Water Quality, and Kelly Kearns of the Wisconsin DNR, as well our guests today. And callers online, so let's take some more calls here. Russ in Stoughton, we'll go to you. Hi, Russ.
Good morning. I had a couple of comments. I wouldn't know an invasive species from a natural one. I'm 74, and I'm still boating and fishing. And at every boat launch, there's a sign that says, you know, you must clean off the weeds off your boat, your trailer. I had yet to ever see a spigot in a hose. I don't know how you're supposed to do that. Lay underneath a dripping boat and hand pick them off. Doesn't seem to be, I don't know, doesn't seem to be a logical way to do that. And the other question I have is, my brother-in-law lived for years up in Boulder Junction in Vilas County on Middle Gresham Lake. And after a few years, the weeds got so thick around his pier that he couldn't start his outboard next to the pier. So he went and got himself a rake and was raking him in up on the shore. And he was observed by a DNR agent out on the lake and was fined $150 because he hadn't applied for a permit to remove those weeds. So I'm thinking a lot of people who have, you know, lakefront property probably don't know that.
Well, Michelle, let's go to you for a comment. Hi, Michelle.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your comments. I'll try to answer your second part first. So in Wisconsin, you are allowed to manually remove aquatic plants within a 30-foot area of your shoreline frontage without the need for a permit. And so if you're using your hands or a rake that isn't mechanized, that is allowed. However, if you go outside of that 30-foot area or you want to use some sort of a mechanized device, you do need a permit from the Wisconsin DNR in order to do that. Another caveat with that manual removal is that you have to remove any plants that are dislodged from the lake. So you can't just go into the lake, rip them up from the sediment and let them just float there, float over to your neighbor's property. And I think most of the complaints we do get from riparians usually involves them doing the right thing with the rake, but not necessarily removing those dislodged plants from the water body itself.
There we go. And then the boat launch business, I just actually this morning I got a news release from the DNR about you're reminding anglers and boaters to keep the water healthy, Maureen.
Yeah, that's true. Because this weekend, I believe, is the drain campaign, reminding people to drain the water from their boats to prevent the spread of invasive species. And we do, that is a good point that you make about it's tough to get under the boat to remove vegetation that's attached because you got to crawl under there. We do have the grant program where we provide assistance to have tools at boat landings, little grabbers, wands, things to help scrape the plants off of the boats and to grab them off of there. And we are installing those all around the state, but working through our grant program, some kind of a local grant sponsor to be able to do that.
But good question. Yeah, but it's worth doing it. I mean, how long does it take to get under the boat and pull the weeds, clean the boat off as best you can, drain the water? It makes a huge difference, does it not?
Yes, it does hugely. We've got lots of statistics on talking to boaters at the boat landings and who's doing what. If boaters are aware of the laws and how many people are doing it, we've had people observing boaters to see who's actually removing the plants like they should. And most boaters are doing a really fantastic job. But that's why we see fewer invasive species spreading from lake to lake each year. So keep up the good work, boaters.
And let's take another call. Laura in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning. I was just calling. I'm really interested in kind of conservation, and I've been planting lots of pollinator plants around my yard and so forth. And I was wondering if it's advisable to plant like swamp milkweed and buttonbush and like other natives near the shoreline, or if that's going to become a problem, because I don't want to introduce any problem plants like you were talking about earlier.
Michelle, let's go to you.
Yeah, thanks for your call. you know, encouraging native plants or restoring native plants in that nearshore area is a really great thing to do. Not only does it prevent invasives from being able to establish, but it also helps protect water quality, keeps the lake clear, prevents sediment erosion. You certainly do want to make sure that the plants that you are using are native. We don't want to be exacerbating the problem and planting invasives on the shoreline. And the department actually has a Healthy Lakes and Rivers grant, which provides some funding for individuals and lake groups that are looking to restore native habitat, put in rain gardens, water diversion devices. And so that might be something that's worth looking into, especially if that's something that you'd like to do on your property.
Laura, thank you so much. Appreciate the call. Well, I tell you what, we've got a lot more we can talk about here. And there's one one term that I saw about aquatic invasive species. Some are considered commonly rare and rarely common. And I thought, what the heck does that mean? Somebody want to explain that for me? Michelle?
Yeah, you know, you have to think about it a couple times and maybe say it out loud. But the general principle of the commonly rare, rarely common is that many AIS have unfortunately been able to establish in lakes across the state and other wet areas. But the number of areas where these AIS are overly abundant and really causing severe problems is actually quite low. And so it's a little bit counterintuitive to maybe what we think about invasive species. Sometimes they get into a system and they're kept in check, whether it's by ecological means or other native plants. And in a rarer number of cases, the invasives really do cause widespread problems. And so it's kind of a new way of thinking now, being able to predict which lakes will have, you know, invasives that behave well versus invasives that behave poorly. That will probably keep me employed for a couple more years here at least. So it's a growing area of science.
David in Superior, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, hello. I want to know why it is that municipalities or governments seem to be either ineffective or unwilling to ban importation of AIs in the first place.
Okay. Maureen, do you go ahead?
Yeah, so about working with the municipalities to prevent them from coming in. I'm a little less clear on what you mean by ban, but most municipalities have been very cooperative with us to follow the rules, the NR40 regulations, that it's illegal to introduce, to transport, to sell these species. So we find that they've been fairly cooperative. It sounds like maybe you've worked with municipalities that haven't been, and that's unfortunate. So we do have local resources and local partners within each county, and then even sometimes at the town level that you can connect with. On our DNR website, we have information of who the local county AIS coordinator, aquatic invasive species coordinator is, and then you can connect with that person and they can make sure that if you have a problem, what the resources are that they can work with, that you can work with, to make sure that the town is aligned with the NR40 regulations.
There you go, David. Thank you. Terry and Willard, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Say, I've in recent years, I've been seeing yellow irises and they're certainly very beautiful. And then I've heard that they're a problematic invasive. And I was just wondering about the yellow irises.
Yeah. Maureen?
Yellow iris are a restricted invasive species in the state, and they're more widespread in parts of the state than others. But there have been a lot of lake groups that have made the effort to remove the yellow iris from their shorelines and put it back in the native plants. And that's something we do want to encourage, actually. It is a beautiful plant. It's also very easily to distinguish because it's so unique and so pretty. I actually have yellow iris that I found in my neighbor's property, and I plan to knock on their door and inform them. A lot of it has to do with it's a pretty, really pretty plant that people want to plant, but they just don't know that it can be bad.
All right. Thank you for calling. And Larry in Janesville wondered, does the university have an app for identifying plants, trees, weeds, all kind of invasive species? Kelly, let's go to you.
Sure. The university has a program run by Mark Renz's lab called the Wisconsin First Detectors Network. And that one actually is connected to the EDMAPS, which is an early detection mapping system nationwide. And if you go on that, if you get yourself set up on it, then you can actually go through and there's images of many of the invasive species on there, both plants and animals. And so you can report them using that. There are many other apps out there as well, like iNaturalist has one called Seek, where you can actually take a photo of the organism and it will hopefully help you identify it. So there's a lot of apps out there for that purpose.
Well, I tell you what, it's been great talking with you, the three of you, today. And I know that there's an aquatic invasive website, right, that people can go to, Michelle?
Yeah, we have an aquatic invasive species website on our DNR page. It has a lot of information about these species we talked about, has some more information on NR40. So I know it's going to be updated soon, so keep an eye out on it, and lots of new information coming your way.
Well, thank the three of you for being with us today. Marine Ferry, aquatic invasive species monitoring lead. And Michelle Nault, Lakes and Reservoir Ecologist at the Bureau of Water Quality. Kelly Kearns with us as well. Kelly will be back after noon, but we'll turn our attention to forest pests next. But Maureen, Michelle, thank you so much. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to get an update on invasive plants and animals in Wisconsin. We have talked already about terrestrial plants and aquatics, and now we're going to hear about keeping our forests healthy and pest-free. And couple of new guests for you right now. Forest pathologist Alex Feltmeyer is with us. Alex, welcome.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for joining us. With her as well, Mike Hillstrom, forest entomologist. Mike, great to have you back.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here.
And Kelly Kearns back again as well. She's been sticking around through the whole show. It's great that she's with us, too. She's the invasive plants coordinator for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program of the Wisconsin DNR. And you know what? You can join in, too. What questions do you have about Wisconsin forest pests? What have you done to control invasive species? How are you fighting forest invaders and pests? I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Alex, start with you. Tell us about your work. What does a forest pathologist do?
Sure. So Mike and I actually share the same role in the DNR. So we are forest health specialists and we cover different geographical regions. So I cover the central part of Wisconsin and Mike covers the southern part of the state. And really our main role is to provide technical expertise in the prevention, detection, and management of invasive plants, insects, and diseases, and specifically those that damage the trees and our forests here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and Mike, you're a forest entomologist as well. Are you not? Talk about your work too, the insects that are, and some are very important to our forests, I think.
Absolutely. So we have probably 25,000 species of insects native to Wisconsin, but a lot of times what we end up talking about are, you know, the big name invasives, the emerald ash borers of the world. So that's what we're here to chat about today.
Well, what are some of the good ones out there?
Oh, there's all kinds of great native insects in our forests. A lot of the insects, honestly, that are the invasive species have native counterparts that do a lot of good work in you know, recycling wood and breaking down trees to give those nutrients back to the forest. You know, there's all kinds of beautiful caterpillars and moths and butterflies out there in the forest. There's a lot of great pollinator habitat in forests. So, you know, a lot of those conservation issues that we talk about in prairies and other areas apply to forests equally.
So what other, do you partner with other organizations, the two of you as well? Alex, go ahead.
Yes, we do. So we work with our state foresters, but we also partner with urban forestry professionals, county foresters, and other private landowner groups, such as the Woodland Homeowners or Woodland Owners Association. And we work together with all of those different agencies to develop management for specific forest health insects and diseases.
Well, let's go back to those bugs again that aren't so much fun. Mike, you mentioned the emerald ash borer in Wisconsin. You know, what should landowners be doing about it?
Yeah, so I think the important thing at this point is to recognize that emerald ash borer has become common across the southern half of the state. You know, we're really feeling the impacts of ash tree mortality across the southern part of the state. In the north, you know, the population's a little bit more scattered, but that really means that now is the time to take that action and deal with any ash trees on your property so that you don't have, you know, hazard trees down the road, or you don't have issues, you know, with sites flooding out. So one of the big concerns we have for northern forests is a lot of these ash trees are growing on wetter sites, and then it can be much more difficult to kind of access those trees and do proper forest management. So in the end, our message is, you know, sustainable forest management. So what can we do as those ash trees die to kind of replace them with another forest that will maintain those ecosystem services that we all appreciate about our forests?
Yeah, and it's tough to deal with, I guess, in a forest situation too. You know, yeah, you can walk in the woods, and I can pick out the where the ash trees are, in a lot of those places that I visit, at least, because they're dying or dead. And what's the management approach to this?
So, you know, we have a bunch of different strategies that we're using. One of the big things we've been doing more recently is there's a really what appears to be an effective biocontrol program. So there's a few species of wasps that are being released that do a really good job of eating emerald ash borers. And the important thing is there's been a lot of time, a lot of money spent in making sure that these wasps that are being released are very specific to emerald ash borer and are not going to harm other native insects or anything like that. And there's no concern for the public. They're so tiny, they could fly into you and you wouldn't even know they were there. So they're doing a big part. On top of that, it's really up to forest landowners to think ahead about, you know, if you have a lot of ash in your stand, how can you start reducing that amount of ash and trying to encourage some of the other tree species that are native to the area to move into that area and take over that space.
Talking with Alex Veltmeyer, Mike Hillstrom, and Kelly Kearns, and zeroing in on forest pests and invasives that affect our Wisconsin lands. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Alex, I know you know, there's some harmful fungi and so forth in our forests, and I'm wondering about the status of oak wilt in the state and what landowners should be doing or looking out for. I served on the Dane County Tree Board for quite a few years, and oak wilt was always almost top of the mind sometimes as an issue.
Absolutely. So for those who haven't heard of oak wilt, it is one of our most important fungal diseases of oak in Wisconsin. And it's fairly common throughout the central and southern part of the state, but still considered uncommon in the northern part of Wisconsin. And it rapidly kills oak in the red oak group, so oaks with pointy leaves. And it causes a slower decline in oak of the white oak groups, those with rounded leaves. It's carried above ground by native beetles that deposit the fungus on freshly made wounds, so during pruning or harvesting practices. And it causes trees to wilt rapidly, starting from the top of the canopy moving downward. And these symptoms are starting in early July, so in the next month or so, we'll be looking out for oak wilt, and it'll continue through the growing season. The best way to prevent, or the best way to manage oak wilt is prevention. So there's a high risk period for oak wilt, which is April 1st through July 15th in the south and April 15th through July 15th in the north. And the best way to manage is to prevent harvesting or pruning practices during the high risk period. And also there's a really great interactive map online if you Google oak wilt and Wisconsin DNR, and you can actually see where oak wilt is distributed throughout the state. So you can, and it has the interactive guidelines on there as well. So you can determine if you're within an oak wilt infested area and you should be following those guidelines.
And definitely should not be pruning your oak trees right now because I've heard the vectors can get to a wounded tree in really short order. I think I remember seeing a piece of research that showed where they actually made a cut and then watched, and it was like 2 minutes or something, and there was already a bug there. Absolutely amazing, Alex.
It's they're incredible, the beetles that carry the fungus, and they're very efficient in carrying the fungus directly to a susceptible tree. So, yes, like you said, very important. Don't be pruning right now.
Dennis in Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Larry. Some people complain about woodpeckers, and I just wonder which is more harmful, the woodpeckers or the insects the woodpeckers are trying to get to?
Oh, Mike, what have you got for our caller, Dennis?
So woodpeckers are definitely an important part of, you know, of the forest system. So I definitely would say, you know, the woodpeckers are just doing what they're supposed to be doing and finding those insect larvae in there. So while they could be going after either native or invasive insect larvae. So woodpeckers can do a very good job of finding things like emerald ash borer. But there's other woodpeckers. What we often get calls about are sapsuckers that will make those lines of holes on your trees. And in general, although it can look bad, it's not going to usually affect the long-term health of the tree. They usually, you know, make a few rows and we'll move on and you don't have an issue again. Occasionally they do more damage than that, but in general, I would say there's really no reason to be concerned about woodpeckers. They're doing a great service in the forest.
Thanks, Dennis. Appreciate it. Jim in Hudson, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about, nightshade, bittersweet nightshade that not only grows on land, but is clogging up areas of my pond, especially where it drains out. And the other part of my question is, any suggestions on dealing with Japanese knotweed that's on banks?
Okay. Somebody want to, Kelly, let's get you involved here for a minute. Hi, go ahead.
Sure. So the knotweed, the nightshade is a pretty weedy species that really probably best in a situation where it's near water like that to just hand pull it out if possible using rakes or some other tools, and then just keep doing that throughout the growing season for a couple of years and making sure that you do it before those seeds ripen so that you can keep new plants from establishing. And then the knotweed is definitely problematic. It's especially problematic on shorelines where we're trying to get people to do more control of it because a small segment of root washed downstream can start a new population. Fortunately, most of our knotweed probably is not producing viable seed. So it's mostly just spreading by root systems. And to control it, it's really a matter of cutting it back and then either using an herbicide that will translocate to the roots or repeatedly cutting it back many, many, many times a year. if you don't want to have to use an herbicide near water. If you do want to use that herbicide, then you're going to have to be using an herbicide that's approved for use near water. You're going to have to get a permit to do that. And you need to make sure that the person doing the application has is certified on applying herbicide near water. So it is an effort.
It is an effort indeed. Jim, thanks. You could join in too, 800-642-1234, taking a look more at forest pests right now on the show. Mike, I want to go back to you because it seems like there's been some increasing gypsy moth populations in parts of Wisconsin and neighboring states as well. Should landowners be concerned?
So I actually just had a phone call right before we got on air here from a landowner concerned about gypsy moth. And, you know, we've been getting more calls this year than we have in probably the past 10 years. So populations are on the rise. Michigan saw almost 1 million acres of defoliation last year. Ontario up in Canada, 600,000 acres. So it definitely seems like we're moving more into an outbreak phase. Whether that will, how much that will affect Wisconsin is kind of yet to be determined, but we're definitely getting more calls about gypsy moths than we have in the past years. So it's an awareness thing. Landowners, forest owners should be out, you know, monitoring their woods, looking for egg masses, looking for caterpillars on the trees. And, you know, if they're starting to see those, there's some really great resources. If you go to gypsymoth.wisconsin.gov, all kinds of great resources for landowners on how to manage gypsy moth, or absolutely get in touch with me or Alex, and we're happy to talk you through what you can do to manage gypsy moth issues on your property.
And how does someone get a hold of you guys? Through your website, I assume, the DNR website? Or
yep, so if you go to the DNR website and search for Forest Health Staff, or if you just want to, again, go to your web browser and search Wisconsin DNR Forest Health Staff, you'll find us and our phone numbers, and we all have smartphones on us all the time, so you can text us photos of what you're seeing or email us photos. We're happy to take a look and make sure, you know, we're properly diagnosing what's going on and help you figure out what to do about it.
That's great. Alex, back to you for a minute. There's something called heterobasidian root disease. Tell me about that disease.
Sure. So heterobasidian root disease was formerly called anosum. So a lot of people remember it as anosum, but it's a fairly destructive fungal pathogen that causes mortality in red pine plantations. And the main host is red pine, but we also find it on white pine, jack pine, spruce, and balsam fir. It's found in 28 counties here in Wisconsin, and we have a great map online that actually indicates exactly where the current infections are found. And just like oak wilt, the best management is prevention as well. So the fungus enters through freshly cut stumps. So if you're harvesting pine in a plantation, or even if you're in a neighborhood that was put into a plantation, the fungus will actually be distributed by the wind and drop onto the stumps and start infecting surrounding living trees because it travels through the root system. So if you're harvesting between April 1st and November 30th, there are two fungicides that are sprayed onto the stumps, and it prevents the spread of the disease.
So that's something they ought to be doing every time they're cutting in that time period then?
On state lands, part of our guideline is that we require the application of the fungicides on state lands during harvesting practices. It's highly recommended for landowners getting harvesting practices done on their own private land, but it's not mandatory.
Rod in Verona, we'll go to you. Hi, Rod.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think she just answered my question, though. I have some red pines that are gradually dying. They've been there for, I don't know, 40, 45 years, and they're wilting away. I thought maybe they were just overcrowded, but some are even out in more open areas are dying. And I've noticed out along Highway 14 where they planted a lot of windbreak stands, a lot of those are dying too. So that must be the problem.
Well, Alex, comment?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about that. There are several things that will cause red pine and other pine species to maybe decline and go downhill. And if you are interested, the forest health staff does assist in diagnosis. So there are other things besides heterobsidian root disease that will kill trees. And sometimes it is important to figure out kind of ballpark what's going on there so you can prevent the spread of whether it be bark beetles or another fungal problem. And that's one of our primary roles is diagnosis and management recommendations.
So how does Rod, is the DNR forester that's going to take a look at it? Somebody will come out and take a look at it?
The regional forest health specialist. So again, if you go online and Google the forest health staff, it actually has a map of which counties that we cover. So there are five of us total. I cover the central region. So if he falls within my zone, he would call me and we would schedule a time to make that site visit and get that management done.
Very cool. And that, and of course that would work for anybody in the state can actually request that kind of assistance, right?
That is correct. However, if landowners are, if it's more of an urban situation, so anything less than maybe 5 acres, we do have urban forestry specialists with the DNR, and that information is on the website as well.
Okay. Rod, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Anything new? Are there some new invasives that we need to worry about in our forests, or what are the newest ones out there?
Yeah,
go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, so there's always something new, it seems like. in the modern world of, you know, international trade and everything else, there's always something new coming in. So there are definitely a few species we're watching for. Asian longhorn beetle. It's a big 2-inch long kind of black beetle with white spots. Has showed up in a few places. So Ohio, a few places on the East Coast, and then it just popped up in South Carolina last year. So that's one we're always watching for because it attacks maple trees in particular. And obviously that would be a huge concern for, you know, for Wisconsin's forest. So that's a major one we're looking for. Hemlock woolly adelgid is a little kind of aphid-like insect that attacks hemlock trees. And then spotted lanternfly is one that I expect people will be hearing more and more about in Wisconsin. It's kind of mostly in Pennsylvania at the moment, but it's another one like gypsy moth that can feed on tons of different host species, you know, 200, 300 different species. And those excrete basically sugar water from their feeding, and then mold grows on that. So there's a lot of complaints from citizens about that one. So it's nowhere close to us that we know of at the moment, but those are definitely three kind of species we're watching for as they get closer to Wisconsin.
Oh, do you ever get frustrated? you get one problem solved and here comes 10 more? Alex? or
we
Mike?
We get excited mostly. And we really do. We read up on all these new insects and diseases and get excited about what could happen. So,
well, yeah. And Mike, last
quick
word.
I just wanted to add, you know, in the modern world of kind of how things are going with, you know, biological controls and tree breeding and stuff like that, I think we're really getting into a better looking future here where we're going to have more and more management tools to deal with these kinds of insects and diseases. So I guess there's always something new coming in, but I think it's more and more hopeful that we're going to have new ways and more effective ways to deal with these insect and disease issues. So don't look at it as a lost cause. It's something, you know,
okay,
we just need to work towards solving.
Alex, Mike, Kelly, thank you both, all three of you, very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Here we are out of time, but it's been a great 90 minutes, and certainly the last 30 minutes have been wonderful. Thank you very much for being with us. And I hope you'll stay around as you listen in here. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.